This is an interview with Lawrence Chase, who served with the United States Air Force during the Korean War. This interview is being conducted at Slinger High School in Slinger, Wisconsin, on the following date of May 22nd, 2007. The interviewer is Tyler Allen Pulliam. Can you describe how you found out you'd be stationed in Japan rather than Korea?
They asked for people to be on guard duty, as it was called, on the ship, shipping over to, we didn't know exactly where we were going to go at that time. They didn't let you know until you got on the ship. Anyways, I got lightheaded because these buildings kept moving up and down, and I didn't know that it was a ship that was moving up and down. I almost lost my cookies that way, but anyways, I did make it all the way over to Japan. What they gave you a 3x5 card, and if it was blank, that meant one thing. If it had a red slash on it, it was another thing. And if it had an X on it, a red X, large X from corner to corner, the large X meant that you were going to Busan, which was in South Korea. Yeah. What we call K9, the base there that I used to fly into. And if you had a slash on it, you were going to go to Yokohama and get off and be stationed in Japan, which is what happened to me. Those that were blank went down to Manila, to probably Clark Field or wherever down there. Anyways, I was stationed at Tachikawa, Japan.
Seeing that the Korean War was bound with new technology and that Korea was the first war with helicopters, I was wondering if you personally had any experience with new equipment or helicopters while you were stationed in Japan.
We did not have helicopters there. They were very popular in Korea, yeah, as you tell by the TV series MASH. Yeah. We did have two helicopters came onto the front of our hangar here, and we were not a helicopter repair outfit. Probably down the line they might have been, but there was, my mother's maiden name was Brown, B-R-A-U-N, and there was a Sergeant Brown that lived in a room next to me in the barracks, and I'll never forget this. This pilot on his helicopter had what was called a moose, a girlfriend, in the village, and what happened is that when you did a repair on a helicopter, overhaul on the engine, rotors, or whatever, you were supposed to bring it up a certain height, so if something happened, you could fall back to earth, yeah, without having any fatalities or serious injuries. But this clown was a real, this pilot had a silk scarf on. He was one of those throttle jockey types. And I couldn't believe it. The Sergeant Brown was with him. He was, he knew helicopters. And he was the crew chief, so to speak, that went along with this pilot. But I'll never forget, it took off from the front of the hangar. It went over the hangar, and it started in flames. I saw it, and it landed in the village. And Sergeant Brown, he was a staff sergeant, he was killed outright. The pilot would have lived if he didn't have that silk nylon scarf around his neck. But what happened is that he was burned so bad by that scarf that he didn't survive. He was in the hospital. Yeah. But I'll never forget the MPs coming in and taking that footlocker out of Sergeant Brown's room next to where I was. And it just got to me. I don't know. I guess I'm overly conscious.
Could you tell us a little bit about the planes you were involved with at the base?
Yeah, we had 119s. C-119s across the base at Tachikawa, and they had a big push on one time where they were, the U.S. or allies were going, U.N. was going on an offense, and they were needed supplies and troops and everything. And at Tachikawa, I'll never figure out how they kept this mess straightened out, but every 20 seconds a 119 or C-47 was landing or taking off in 20 seconds, and I sat out on a C-54, which was a four-engine plane, tricycle gear, and I just couldn't believe how coordinated that was, because they had this big push. They were all going to Korea is what they were doing.
Were you actually a mechanic on the airplanes, or were you in charge of that department?
I was a clerk typist.
Okay.
And so as a result, I was told that if I went out on the flight line, I would not get any more promotions, which I cared less about because I was in career anyways. I went on the flight line, and I never got per diem paid.
Oh, yeah.
I had to have people check everything that I
did.
And some people were nothing but inspectors, but I enjoyed it.
And now you had mentioned some specific things about your office that you had worked in the upstairs portion of it.
Yeah, that was it was classified. In fact, as a clerk typist, I was cleared to secret.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was a top secret, and then there was a one where only a few people knew anything about. But because the reports that I handled were secret, I got to know things that I probably shouldn't have. At our base, we had four B-26s, and we had the D-mount. The back turret gun on top behind the canopy was, there's a slope behind the canopy there. There was a gun there. That was taken out, and as a result, we cut a hole in the bottom of the bomb bay, came up. We made a probably 3x3 with leatherette and cushion, and had an escape hatch put in. We took out the canvas bag that caught the shells from the gun that was removed, and at that site, it was at the back wall of the airplane. We rigged up three lights. There was a green, a red, an orange, or yellow, and a green. And what happened is that at Iwakuni, on the west side of Japan, the pilots that went on this flight was just one person.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a person that really didn't care if he lived or died. He was a mercenary is what he was, special trained pilot. But these B-26s that we took care of, we had four of them there. One was trainer, and three of them were used in drops. They would go to Iwakuni and pick up a brainwashed North Korean and haul that person into Manchuria, which was on the west side of Korea, and then they would come back, infiltrate into North Korea as spies. That when that pilot and would pick up that double agent, so to speak, who had a parachute, that agent would look at the lights that we had put in there, and if it was red, that was fine because he didn't have to jump. Then it was orange where he had to get himself ready.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it flipped to green, he dropped out. And there was no radio contact at all. So we'd wait for these airplanes to come back, and the tower, nobody had any information whether they'd even get back. Most of them made it coming back. And it was something that the U.S. denied we were doing.
Now, did you discover this through your typing of papers and your work in the office, or was this something that was commonly thrown in your daily schedule?
Well, it wasn't all that common because there weren't that many flights. But one day, a officer from upstairs at that operations building that nobody else knew was up there, really, it seemed like, told me to get on a weapons carrier that we had on the base and back up to this airplane. What happened is that it had gotten stranded out on the taxiway for some reason or other. Well, these weapon carriers have mirrors in them, so you can you can see what's happening. Well, this fella didn't look to me like he was Japanese either, and so he wasn't American, but. Anyways, you could put two and two together, but after a while, it kind of became, when you're working on the airport, on the airplane, obviously, it's not your run-of-the-mill B-26. That happened also one time on a B-17. Later on, when Chiang Kai-shek was kicked out of China, so to speak, and went to Formosa, which is now Taiwan, and I've flown into Formosa at that time, there was a paratrooper from Brooklyn, and he was a football team, a player on the team, the base football team. He was a character, a big guy, but he was training Chinese paratroopers for a invasion of the mainland of China under Chiang Kai-shek. And again, they sent me out there with a weapons carrier, and I could never figure out, if you look at a B-17, how those people on that right rear door in front of the horizontal stabilizer, why they never got their neck caught on that thing, I'll never figure out. But what happened is a pilot on the B-17 loaded with these paratroopers that were practicing. He got his nose out too far toward the runway, and the tower told him to turn around, and when he did, the tailwheel of the B-17 dropped off. So, again, somebody from upstairs came down, told me to back up, and I never saw so many Chinese in my life get on this weapons carrier, and I had to back it up to the hangar and keep my eyes ahead. But you have a mirror there, you can see what's going on.
Now that we've heard all of your experiences during the military, is there anything that you wanted to add in at the end of the closing of you being in the military?
I was lucky because I wasn't on the front lines, let's put it that way. But when you saw some of the planes at Kimpo that were shot up, that gets you thinking, you know, and the Marines especially. In 1953, a C-124 came into Tachikawa. At the end of the war, they had an exchange of prisoners of war. And if in Korea, it got so cold in the mountains, especially when MacArthur wanted to go across the Yalu, which would have really upset things, up in that area, those people literally froze up there. And these prisoners of North Korea were exchanged and coming back to be repatriated, so to speak, or come back to the U.S. And on this C-124 had big clam doors in front. But the dignitaries at Tachikawa, I mean, the people from Washington or wherever had arranged this thing. I'll never forget when those clam doors opened up, all of these politicians came out first down this ramp. And then you saw guys that were on knees and elbows because their feet were frozen and their hands were frozen and they couldn't walk. That came down that ramp on their knees and elbows. They were literally frozen, victims of a frostbite. And I'll never forget this. They came down and they kissed the ground. They were so glad to be out of Korea. That sticks in my mind. Those are the guys that are the heroes.